Welcome. We're about to start the part two of our today's session, and this second session we've allotted 1 hour for it. We may be able to run over a little bit and cover some questions. In the first session, we were unable to get to everybody's questions. We got inundated a little bit, but we will we'll have those all archived, and we'll get back and try to get back to you guys with as many answers as we can offline on this. Just so everyone knows, this session, as are the other two sessions, will all be recorded. We'll have those posted by sometime later this evening at healthyindoors.com. So you'll be able to watch those and review them. There'll be Vimeo stream videos there. Also, any of the PowerPoints or slides or anything that any of the presenters have shared will also be available there. And so, you know, just is with your control panel as an attendee here, the lower, if you move your mouse cursor down to the lower part of your screen, you'll have a nice little toolbar that pops up. And your options are going to be, you have a Q&A and a chat bar there. And what we'd like you to do is, for any questions you'd like to have the panel address, we'd like you to put it in the Q&A. Actually type your question in there. The chat, we're trying to reserve and not have questions because we're not monitoring it as closely. The chat will be more for us to be able to give you links to websites, that sort of thing. We can post up there. So we'd like to keep the questions in Q&A. It'll just be easier for us to manage those. But again, you feel free if you want to chat amongst yourselves in the chat, you're welcome to do that. Just we probably won't be able to respond to you directly. So, all right. Well, without further ado, let's get this going here. Our panel for the second session, part two, is titled Managing the Public Health Crisis. And we're going to, in the earlier session this morning, we took on, I think, more of a an overall view. Corbett was the moderator on that. And we were looking at things a lot from the medical perspective, because we had a medical doctor as well as a academic researcher. So we took a little bit of attack there. We did approach a lot of the overall topics here, but in this section right now, our primary focus is going to be what's happening as far as the public health perspective on this, and you know, what are we doing, how is it affecting us, and what are some of the things you can do. And again, we spoke mostly this morning about homes, because we're all now kind of getting quarantined and getting into our own residences. But certainly there's still many of you out there that are still in the workforce and still out in the workplace, right? You know, many people are. So a lot of what we'll be speaking about will apply to both of those. So with us today, no particular order, Dr. David Krause. He's founder of Healthcare Consulting and Contracting, HC3. He's a certified industrial hygienist and toxicologist. He's got 25 years experience in public health, occupational health assessments, and indoor air quality. David was also in charge of the Florida State IAQ division, and I just botched that, but I'll let you elaborate. Dave has a unique perspective in that I've known him for many years. He has worked in the public sector, again, in the public health sector for the state of Florida, as well as in the private sector as a consultant. So it gives him a nice overview, and we're really happy to have him on board today. He's also been involved with many many standard setting and research projects throughout the course of the year, and a feature presenter on numerous industry conferences. Scott Armour, next panelist. Hi, Scott. Scott is an internationally recognized expert on environmental acquired illnesses, mold assessment and remediation, exposure science and data collection methodology, indoor air quality building science, childhood lead poisoning prevention and abatement, and fire investigation. He has a master's of science in health science, and with especially in industrial hygiene. So again, Scott has also worked extensively with industry standards, most recently and currently, right, with the IICRC S520 with the mold standard. But he's been, you know, some major projects both here in the U.S. and actually in Canada. So you've been involved in a lot of aspects around the world dealing with public health concerns. So yep. Good to have you. My third panelist. Third panelist is Tim Hebert, a longtime friend of mine. We both started a long time ago back in the early days of air duct cleaning with the National Air Duct Cleaners Association. And I had the privilege of serving on the board of directors for over a decade with Tim and working on numerous research projects. But Tim is he's an AHA certified healthcare constructor and an ACAC certified microbial consultant. He has over 25 years experience in indoor air quality, testing, building envelope diagnostics, HVAC hygiene assessments. He's one of the foremost people in the country in HVAC hygiene. So make no mistake about that. We're really privileged to have him on board. And he's the principal investigator and project manager for air purification specialist in Pavo, Georgia. And welcome here. Good to see you. And of course, we have Corbett Lunsford. Corbett, I'll let you introduce yourself quickly if we have some new people on board.
Again, the amateur in this group. So my specialty is testing the invisible dynamics. I always break it down into physics, chemistry, and microbiology. I wrote the book, Home Performance Diagnostics, The Guide to Advanced Testing, only because no one else had written it and I wanted a book like that. My wife and I also make Home Diagnosis, which is the first ever television series about the science of homes. And I am here to absorb what this panel is going to say so that I can then shuttle it into this PBS series that we've got. So we're just trying to communicate as much about the science of homes as possible to normal Americans.
And I guess I'll introduce myself again. I'm Bob Krell. I'm the founder and publisher of Healthy Indoors Magazine. You can get to that. It's a free monthly digital and quarterly print publication available at healthyindoors.com. I'm the president of IAQ Technologies in Syracuse, New York. So I've been involved in numerous aspects of the industry as a contractor, initially as a consultant, as a trainer, and now as a publisher. So it's been an interesting perspective that I think I've been able to achieve, because I've worked pretty much in every state in the country over the course of my 33 years in this industry. And I've had the unique opportunity to be on both the consultant and the contractor side in various applications. So, you know, I refer to it as my multiple personality, right? You know, got the one hat's the contractor hat, one hat's the consultant hat. And, but I think it does, you know, it does give me a unique perspective here, and I'll certainly, chime in as the moderator today. So, looking forward to just getting a little bit deeper in the weeds. I think one of the things, that I'd really like to talk about, you know, just to start out with is, why is this different? Why, you know, we're dealing with, you know, this pandemic. We've heard the term pandemic before many, many times, correct? Over the years, we had SARS, we had numerous other Ebola scare that really was very catastrophic in Africa, but didn't really hit the United States with any fervor. Why is this different? Now, let me throw it out to David first.
Sure. This is different because it's turned into community widespread of a highly infectious virus. I think that it has been recognized and anticipated by public health officials since, I'll say, at least after the anthrax attacks in 2001. We recognized we were highly vulnerable when an epidemic begins. You're not quite sure if it's man-made or bioterrorist attack or natural and naturally occurring or a little bit of both. We established programs and spent billions of dollars in this country preparing for just this event. As far back as 2004, 2006, there was quite a bit of effort, a lot of money spent on this, a lot of efforts preparing, you know, millions and millions of N95s, requirements for hospitals and National Guard and police to have the equipment necessary to do that and respond and be prepared and be safe. And that was essentially dismantled over the past 10 to 15 years. It's been slowly defunded, sometimes rapidly defunded. The expertise has been whittled away. And so we can sit back here and armchair quarterback this and tell you, yes, we knew this was coming. The most upsetting thing is that we spent the money to prepare for it, and then we got rid of it. So I think that's one aspect. The other aspect here is that that early surveillance and the ability to do testing on to answer the hundreds of questions that we're receiving today just wasn't done. And we're at the point where we really don't have any other options other than to establish broad-based quarantines.
I mean, are you seeing, like, are we experiencing a similar effect just several months later from what, you know, initially started in China? Because again, they were fairly ill prepared initially, as was Italy clearly, and, you know, many other countries. We've watched this virus move its way around the globe.
This is entirely expected. This is how pandemics work. This is how viruses spread across the globe. Even in the tabletop exercises and preparation exercises that we did back in the early mid 2000s, we expected it to start in China. Public health professionals, we expected them to deny that it was going on. We expected it to jump borders. We expected it to hit high population areas. We expected it to hit the elderly. We expected it to hit airports and transportation facilities. We also had a number of other tools that we should have been able to implement had they not been dismantled, not just by this administration, but previous ones as well. We've watched these slow balls fly by.
Yeah, I saw a number on a thing I was watching a few days ago saying that our national budget, it's like less than 0.01% is public health. You know, that's kind of a scary thought right now, isn't it? So Scott, you've been involved in a lot of obviously not pandemic situations, but in small scale situations where it's been, you know, a public health concern. How is this different in your perspective?
There, you know, when I look across and you track it, like say when the best information in January started to come through and you begin to take a bigger look at it, I think the most important thing is, you know, we look at transmission of disease. I was looking at transmission of information. And we live in a world now where information is instant and broadcast through many channels, right? You can hear the same piece of news 100 times a day. One of the things I think that did was that it heightened that awareness that something was going on. If you look at the numbers of disease, it is not as large as one would think if you're just watching the news compared to what's actually out there. Compare the numbers. We have almost 8 billion people in the world and 200,000 cases. Do the math. That is a fraction of 1%. In fact, I think it's 1/1000th of 1%. So there's a lot of zeros before, you know, 0.0000, right? It's really small. However, if we look at New York City as a perfect example right now. If we had 500 or 1,000 new hospitalized cases just to New York City, that begins to overwhelm the hospital system. It is not a huge risk to each individual, but to the system, it is an enormous impact. Right, our responses, our resources to respond to those 500 or 1,000 new cases. Look at Italy, in northern Italy, it's horrendous because these little towns are getting slammed and they have no response. So it's hard to balance. The biggest problem is that if you think that the risk or the fear or impact is like that hospital that's being overwhelmed by 500 new patients, you begin to respond as if that's your necessary daily response. And I think that's the mix up right now. So we have a lot of closures, we have a lot of over response in my side of the industry. Now, how do we come up with standards? How do we address this? And that then pushed us further and further away from the very simple basic cleanliness and disinfection that we see from recommendations from places, learned places like CDC, the OSHA responses to people pushing just almost ridiculous responses. So that really impacts people's decisions. That I think is the hardest thing to cope with. And obviously the financial and economic, we don't even have time or ability to understand that right now.
I mean, when you look at the numbers statistically, we currently have we have approximately just under 1 million hospital beds total in the United States. I think the number was like 980,000 something, somewhere
yeah,
around.
Yeah, I think
there.
I heard that too.
Which equates to, you know, with given our total population, about 2.8 beds per 1,000 people. You know, now Germany, for example, has 8 beds per 1,000. South Korea has 12 beds per 1,000. You know, we have numbers, you know, we don't have the resources normally. And, you know, and out of those approximate 1 million beds, how many of those beds are actually vacant right now? What's the census in the healthcare facilities?
Very few. Most hospitals I work with on a daily basis, they're at 90 to 95% capacity every day.
Right. So we don't have 1 million beds. That's the point. I see those numbers and I go, there are not 1 million beds available. Just like we have approximately, you know, if you figure the total possible number of ventilator units that we could bring back in, there's a ton that are out of service. You know, we have about 70,000 new high-tech ones, you know, and if we bring the reserves that CDC has and the ones that have been stockpiled, kind of mothballed, we maybe can dial it up to maybe 170, 180,000 units. That's best case scenario. But how many are being used already? That's the point. There's people using those.
Bob, you've got these claims that they're even talking about bringing back hospitals that have closed. And you and I know we've walked into hospitals that have been mothballed, and they are nightmares.
Yeah.
It would take longer to fix the standing buildings because they've been neglected than it would be to build a new one. And I can tell you that the quote mothballed or excess reserve ventilators, they're the same way. And on top of that, it's not the ventilator, it's the people who run it. You're talking 3 to 4 full-time people to keep a person alive on a ventilator. You don't just stick them on a ventilator and walk away. You've got to have pulmonologists, you've got to have respiratory therapists, you've got to have nurses, you've got to have all the functioning structure behind it to make that ventilator worthwhile. It's like having a car but a driver.
I'm going to jump ahead of you here. You have a point there?
I was going to comment. It is clear this is more an infrastructure response crisis than it is a health crisis when you look at the numbers, right? You want to balance the numbers. How many flus, how many flu deaths, things like that. If this were left unchecked, it could easily surpass our annual death totals, fatality totals of the flu, right?
Sure.
Worst year is 60,000 deaths. That's a lot of deaths.
That's a lot of deaths.
From flu. This, think about this, could be anywhere from 5 or 10 times that if it were completely left unchecked. But even if this were only 1/10 of that, that's 6,000 more that we don't have capacity for, plus the serious illness. And that's really what this is.
Well, and remember, all the other injuries and illnesses, surgeries and heart attacks, strokes, all those are still happening.
Yeah, they're not going away.
Right.
And here's the other problem too, is that I think we're grossly underestimating the numbers, right? Because, you know, we're talking about how many cases there are. These are cases that have been tested and confirmed. Okay, most people on the planet of the 8 billion people have not been tested. I would suspect that we are 100 to 1,000 times that currently with people that are exposed. But anyway, I want to direct it over to Tim now, because we've been mentioning trying to recommission old healthcare facilities, bringing facilities back, or even just upscaling existing facilities. Tim's had a lot of experience, right, working in the healthcare environment, dealing with the HVAC systems and just the indoor environments in these buildings. And, you know, how do we deal with this in such a fast ramp up?
I think the challenge would be to identify first. And I think Scott and David's comments are most appropriate. I do agree with Scott that the infrastructure is probably our limiting factor. But at the same time, how do you prepare for a pandemic? Do you forward that much funding to something that you may or may not use? And it's a investment strategy that everyone has to take a bite of and determine, is that the best way to spend the money? Or can we back up and learn from this? And I guess I probably need to pull back a little bit and give you a 30,000 foot view. And to do that, this is not a national crisis. This is obviously a worldwide crisis. But let me see if I can put a different perspective on it. And I'll get back to the hospitals in a moment, Bob. But there's a great quote, and it was from Thomas Paine back in 1776. And he said, "These are the times that try men's souls." And it's directly from the 1776 pamphlet, Common Sense, that was published right prior to the American Revolution. First off, I'm happy to be in America for this crisis. if anyone can beat this, we can. We're independent thinkers. We're innovators. We come from good stock. Our parents, no matter what the nationality, revere freedom and freedom to live our lives and raise our families as we see fit. We love our freedoms, and we solve the impossible to maintain those freedoms in our way of life. We face challenges head on. The old saying of damn the torpedoes, full steam ahead, that's our motto. My mom's a 97-year-old World War II veteran who served in the Pacific Theater. She grew up in a single-parent home during the Depression and then was immediately pushed into the Great War. She never let herself become a victim. She calls herself a survivor. Today's identity politics of victimization just confuse me. But what encourages me is not only will I believe we'll come out of this crisis stronger and more focused, but the opportunities that are going to come from this are going to be immense. It's been four generations since the American people have truly been challenged with survival of ourselves and our country. We'll exercise newfound strengths, we'll discover new abilities, and we'll bring to the table things that will truly help us, not only in our country, but around the world, because we are the most giving country in the world. We're going to figure this out. There's a lot of doom and gloom, and I totally agree with Scott. If you watch the 24-hour news cycle, oh my God, you just want to go crawl in a closet. That's not where we need to be. The numbers don't support that. As David alluded to, though, the potential, because it is so highly virulent and so highly communicable, we have to pay attention. But I think we're going to win this one. As an American, I'm just proud of the fact that we value human life. Other cultures may not as much as we do. So we always set our stakes a little bit higher. We'll beat this. We will take some losses, but we'll survive and we'll prosper as a nation. And as prospering as a nation, we're going to help move the world forward. So that's my positive spin to it. Now, getting back to the immediate issues with the hospitals. And I have a lot of friends online right now watching that we do work with. They're integrally involved with all the hospitals, or hospital engineers, facilities managers, et cetera. They know the challenges, and for the most part, they try within their budgets to maintain their facilities so that they can accommodate these. The phone calls that I'm receiving primarily are for auxiliary isolation rooms. How do we serve up, and we only have, okay, let's say we only have a suite of 8 isolation rooms. How do we turn that into 28? That's the kind of guidance that we're hoping to provide and steer them so that they in turn can go ahead and not fix the entire building, because we all know what a monumental task that would be, but at least provide areas of sanctuary. And I think that's a word that I would heavily emphasize, particularly in the home setting, and I'll speak with Corbett about that later. But if we can provide micro isolation areas, sanctuary, so to speak, not only for the sick, but also for the well that we don't want to become sick, I think that's a defining line that we can use. And can we fix all the hospitals out there instantly overnight? No, that's not going to happen. David alluded to the fact that it's a lot easier to build a new building than to fix some of these. It truly is. I think some of the mobilization that I've seen various militaries around the world being able to enact very quickly with portable MASH units is pretty amazing. I think that technology is going to be advanced very rapidly, so we can move things around and put it where it's needed, not so much where we want it or where we have it, but where we need it. That was one of the beauties of being able to relocate those two hospital ships, one in the New York City Harbor and one over on the West Coast. It's a floating hospital, so that's beneficial. I wish I could tell you that we have magic wands and silver bullets where we could go in and clean up these facilities instantly. You and I have been in this industry way too long. We know that's not going to happen. But if we'll focus just on the smaller bite, and concentrate on cleaning those areas up and making them habitable and useful, I think that's going to be the goal.
So I'd like to jump in real quick, if you don't mind.
I was going to toss to you right then, so go.
Great, and just spin it. I'm not an expert on this. This is a comment and a question for our panel that I just like to point out, and this was put together by me and Bob on a real short schedule. All of the panelists that have been involved in this so far are white. All the people on this call are men. All of us, I'm assuming, are middle class. I happen to live in an area in Atlanta that the town where I live is 36% below the poverty line before this even started. And so I'm just wondering, number one, for the people who were trying to stretch it and make ends meet beforehand, and now we've gotten kids out of school, and of course we know that, you know, as far as drugs go, number one thing is keep kids from getting bored, so they stay off drugs. Second thing is crime in my area is really driven by teenagers. It's a teenager thing, breaking into cars, et cetera. And then also people are desperate, like they were desperate already, right? If you're on that poverty line. And now what is going to happen with this? And is that part of what public health is trying to address? And then also, even going further down the chain, homeless shelters. Those are gatherings of more than 10 people. And for sure, those are not disinfected.
They're tight, yeah, and they're tight, too. They're usually people are like in bunks right together.
Right. So when we're talking about a hospital being a bed is a bed is a bed, doesn't matter whether it's a homeless person or a millionaire, like what's the response on the kind of more desperate end of the spectrum that none of us are necessarily a part of? Is there any conversation around that?
Well, from the public health side of this, that's probably second or third down the list for what they're trying to deal with right now. Last year, we had an active hurricane season that brought in devastation to the panhandle of Florida. What do you do with those people? You put them into shelters. You get them on the road and you move them out of the path. Do not expect hurricanes and tornadoes and all the other crises and natural disasters to stop. We will continue having fires. We will continue having earthquakes. We will continue having other outbreaks. Oh my God. Other types of outbreaks are happening at the same time. So often we as public health officials have a hard time walking and chewing gum at the same time. And when all the resources get sucked to this, other things will fall by the wayside. I can tell you there's very little thought right now, and June starts the hurricane season, to how do we change shelters? How do we deal with sheltering people, you know, patients with the needs, all that? Yes, this it actually will increase people's risk factors going in there. We will not have a cure come this hurricane season. We will not have a vaccine come this hurricane season. And our options are becoming more and more limited. So very valid points. I do not think anyone has a clear, defensible answer to it today.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that alarms me, you know, is that you hit it right there, David, the fact that we're going to go into the hurricane season. And we've had some devastating Category 5 hurricanes over the past several years that have really been, you know, monumental recoveries in those areas. And we're still recovering a lot of places we haven't recovered. And that's based on the fact that it's in a limited geographic area in this large country where we had the rest of the country's resources to throw at it. This is a whole different ballgame now because, like you said, the wildfires and the hurricanes aren't going anywhere. So we're going to still have to, they're going to compound this. And I do worry about, you know, how we're going to address that as we hit it. But again, you have to take on the most, you know, the most pressing matter at a given point.
It's interesting. May I?
Yeah. Please jump in.
It's interesting to think about it because if you look at some of the curves and you do just real simple modeling on, peaks and downslope of infected numbers and transmission rates, that June is right when we should be on the downside. And we're going to take that last few people who are contagious, and they're going to all of a sudden be pushed unwillingly into these new shelters if we were to be hit with another disaster, you know, a natural disaster like a hurricane. So just when you think you're going to be clear, we're going to throw hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands of people all close together. I think that's one of the big picture issues is the length of time that this is going to take to get to where we are at a manageable regular infection rate. You know, this is probably something that's not going to, quote, go away. That's, you know, the hope for vaccine creation, of course, but just to manage, you know, normal activities, you know, this will keep popping up and we're going to have to develop a response system to pockets. So when we have new clusters appear, we've got to trust that CDC and other health folks define what a cluster is for response. Is it 10 people? Is it 100 people? At what number? And you mentioned earlier, and all of us who have discussed this are hyper aware, testing, right? Do we have to test 100% of the population? Do we only test people who start to cough and sneeze and wheeze or get a slight fever? You know, those answers are yet to be done. The volume of research and expertise, as everyone's mentioned, we've known for years, has been cut back, and just drastically cut back recently, unfortunately. But if we don't have that infrastructure rebuilt, the future, whether it's June or August or a year from now, is not going to be much different than it is right now.
I mean, you know, one of the things that worries me, you know, a lot of this worries me, but the fact that, you know, previous, I'm not going to even use the word similar, but previous pandemics, you know, viral type infections, they tend to wane in the summer, right? You know that whole transmission situation. But then, you know, there has been a resurgence on some of these previous pandemics, you know, in the following fall and winter. You know, and are we going to be looking at that? You know, Spanish flu is a great example of, you know, where it had a fairly high death toll right out of the blocks, but then the second year was substantially higher.
Bob, look at Ebola in Congo 6 months ago, what happened, right? We thought it was controlled. We had a huge burst. Look at measles around this country, these little pockets. You know, one of the things I want to point out, and I think Dr. Krause can add to this as well, is this use of the words, the terminologies. And we say pandemic, and we have to remind ourselves what pandemic means. Pandemic means it's reached a certain number of countries. It's worldwide, and there is at least one case in each country. So sometimes pandemic means it has just become a worldwide phenomenon. It does not necessarily mean it's awful or a high incidence rate in all countries, versus an epidemic, which is the uncontrolled spread of the disease to numbers that we haven't seen before. And I think that's real important. A lot of people, we misconstrue that. We don't have a good word for this right now. I don't think pandemic is the fair word. It's a technical word that we could be using over there.
It's certainly an outbreak.
Epidemic.
Yeah, David? It's an outbreak. It's an epidemic. It's as far as the statistics on it, I mean, we can make some good swags at it. But right now, I'll tell you, we're blind. We are blind. We are running blind. We're making assumptions. And public health officials have, you know, uncertain information. Testing, an accurate, reliable, defensible, repeatable test is absolutely necessary. Realistically, most tests have some failure rate. False positives, false negatives, interferences. So we all have to look at the test data that we're provided with a scant eye and recognize that you're not looking at the conditions today. That test and then the body of tests that's finally compiled and presented to epidemiologists and policymakers to make a decision on, it's a shadow. It's a ripple in the water. It's yesterday. It's last week. And with something that has such an apparent, and we'll say apparent because this is obviously a contagious disease, it's ahead of you. You know, where it is not where you're looking right now. And our policymakers and public health officials need to be looking a month ahead, 3 months ahead, 6 months ahead. If they hope to have any chance of getting ahead of this, they have to be thinking about that, not today. And unfortunately, with the demand of the social media cycle and the news cycle, I've sat in these positions where I didn't have time to think as a state toxicologist dealing with a dozen media reports and interviews every day and have time to think about the research and actually go do the testing. So, you know, the limit, the public health officials, the public health programs have been decimated over the past 10, 15 years. They do not have enough people. They do not have enough expertise at the state, even at the federal level. And, you know, they're going to burn out quickly. They are humans as well. They will become ill. And we will see a loss within those ranks as well.
Yeah. Corbett, you're muted, Corbett.
Sorry. Thank you very much. There's been a couple questions popping up, the questions pane and the chat pane, and everybody please use the question and answer pane about profitability for hospitals. And one question that Joe is asking is, it was stated earlier that testing is covered by the U.S. government, but is the hospital stay, as somebody who has had my wife stay in the hospital overnight, it's like $4,000 a day for those beds. Are we really expecting that people are going to cover those? Like, how is that part of the public policy? And are hospitals going to lose a bunch of money and then have to close as well?
Historically, the hospital is on you. You're quarantined. If you're quarantined at the Ritz-Carlton, guess who's paying that bill? It is not the health department. This is very much still, you know, there have not been accounts made, monies made available, to my knowledge, to manage individuals, quarantine, medical treatment. That is why in the past, state epidemiologists were required to be MDs, physicians. They could write scripts. They could write scripts for testing. They could write scripts for hospitalization on a broad scale. I can tell you the state of Florida, that's not the case anymore. Our state epidemiologist is not an MD. They've actually implemented a waiver. Several states have had to do that as well. So we do not have the tools of the past that we knew we needed. We've known it since the days of polio. Of how we needed to have individuals of certain credentials and knowledge and experience sitting there in tune and ready to respond to things like this. So we find ourselves in a less than ideal position.
I mean, are we not encumbered a little bit? You know, I mean, our for-profit health care system, and this is based on a few of the comments too that we've been getting here in the chat box. They're not necessarily incentivized to ramp up unless they can actually have, you know, billable hours. So I mean, the proactive approach to being more prepared at that, you know, I just don't see it happening unless there's some way that's, you know, incentivized. I mean, because again, if you're in a for-profit business model in any business, right, you're not going to ramp your business up if you can't, you know, immediately recover that.
Well, if public health officials deem this, and it is a national emergency, public health authorities at the state and federal level do have certain authorities within their purview that they can implement under times like this to nationalize and require facilities to do that. And traditionally, what happens is Congress comes back at the state and federal level and provides some type of economic payback. You know, there are mechanisms. It's just not up front. They're going to have to do it. It's just as if, you know, public health authorities can order every business in the state to shut down if they need to in order to control this. They can't. They hesitate to do it because it has a devastating impact and has unintended consequences. But they do have the authority to do it. It's kind of the nuclear option, though.
Hey, Bob.
Yeah, hop in.
I think Corbett has pretty much laid out the largest response that not only this short webinar could provide, but also the item of largest benefit for our population as well. And I think he nailed it. And what I'd like to do is just go down through a couple of steps. And someone asked me, what's the first task I would consider under house arrest? And I know I use the term loosely, but I had a really bad case of pneumonia last May. So I'm a little suspect. So I've sequestered. I'm in my office. I'm in my home. But the biggest question that I think every family out there wants to know is, how do I protect my family? How do I provide sanctuary for the ones that I love? By making my living area a sanctuary for myself, my family, my dogs, my cats, whoever. And I really think the word sanctuary is not used enough. But I want to give Corbett a few ideas. You can redesign how you enter your home. Now, you don't have time now for detailed modifications, but use an existing bathroom that's equipped with an exhaust fan as your dirty room. All clothing goes directly into a plastic bag or the washing machine. And by the way, your laundry room makes a great negative pressure room isolation room if the clothes dryer is running. Okay, it's a given. Everybody has one. It's sucking air out of the room, discharging it outdoors, we hope, and creating a negatively pressurized decontamination room. Leave your shoes at the door, for gosh sakes. After flying around the country, the first thing I do is strip down and decontaminate from the airport funk. We all do that. We all grew up with designated mud rooms or snow rooms. its purpose was to separate clean from dirty. We don't need to get technical with every family out there. We just need to provide them some common sense guidance. When I was seven and I played in every mud puddle I could find, Mom would make me strip down in the yard and hose off before I entered her house.
My wife used to do that to me when I was in the Army and coming back from exercises.
Yeah, okay. Well, now if we did that, it'd be interesting because you'd probably be talking to the police. But anyway, so you map out where your dirtier area is. We don't even bring shipping boxes or grocery bags into my home now. Everything is unloaded outside, and then it's transferred in. You leave the bulk packaging outside. And the key to it is educating the families, and Corbin's dead on target with this. He's dead on target with it. So I have a couple of other suggestions. Number one, someone asked me, well, does the idea of sequestration or isolation alarm you? Me? No, I see nothing but opportunity. We have to become willing to learn again. Me, I'm never bored in isolation. There's no way. How often have you said, each one of you, I want you to reflect back on this, man, if I could just take 30 days off and get my act together, I could accomplish so many things I want to do. Well, guess what? You're going to have the opportunity. There's a book out, and I would encourage everyone, even if you just go online and look at some of the quotes, it's entitled Make Your Bed. The first thing out of bed in the morning, get up and make your bed. You've accomplished a task. Okay. How about lose 10 pounds over the next 30 days? Learn to play the guitar. To exercise your lungs, sing in the shower. Your wife may not like it, but, you know, open them up.
See, but Corbett made an interesting point earlier on. Scott, I'll get to you in a sec. You know, as far as the fact that this is not necessarily, you know, like all the solutions we're talking about here are really, you know, kind of based on middle America. You have your own host, your own house, your own laundry room, you're able to do that. And really a large proportion of our population doesn't live in that type of environment. They're living in multifamily housing. They really aren't going to have the opportunity. They're going to have cross, you know, if they're sequestered at home, it's going to be in a home that has 1,000 other people or 500 other people in that same complex, you know, and they don't really, you know, they don't have the same opportunities necessarily. So I'm not sure this is like, you know,
so how do you modify your approach to it then?
That's a good question, Scott. Let me kick to Scott.
I have to say that when we as a group or an industry start to speak and we say things similar to what Chin just said, we're changing the emphasis. So of where the risk is. We really have to look and understand the risk, both as individuals, but also as a community. So when we look at where the most cases are, almost every single large cluster or grouping was because of interaction, right? This prolonged close contact. It was not from shipping boxes at all. In the previous hour, right? Somebody started to mention it, and there was a couple issues that I heard, and it is the virus on the Amazon box, right?
It could be.
But that's not the word.
I get it. I get it.
On the box. It's not likely to become airborne again.
Right. Well, it's not even that it's airborne, right? As much as think of the pathway of this disease. It's in our lungs. We cough. These huge chunks of, some people will call it sputum. Some people will call it spit or phlegm.
Let's call it sputum. Can we call it sputum for the purpose of this?
If we can imagine this, it goes flying into the room. These are very large drops. They hit the ground, or maybe they hit the Amazon box, right? Someone else now has to either be in the way of those flying drops or touch that box and get that spit into their lungs. So it's very difficult to do. So we could have 1,000 boxes. It's not jumping off the box into our lungs.
Scott, you've got a really good point there. But I think a very recent, I think on the 17th, communications through the New England Journal of Medicine, and there's been slightly reported on aerosol and surface stability of SARS-CoV-2, which is the coronavirus we're dealing with.
That was the three-hour estimate.
Yeah, well, it wasn't an estimate. They did measurements, but what struck me was that's when they stopped measuring.
It was, if you look at that, it was a forced suspension, and all they did was determine the viability, right?
Yeah, 5 micron. Well, they did look at the viability and the concentration or the infectious dose.
Right. What they didn't do was go out and see how many of those droplets are actually in the air. Naturally, they forced the suspension. So really, all that looked at, right?
It's not clear. They haven't published the whole article.
Let me bring it down
a technical level real quick, just to say that the Amazon boxing that we were worried about, if you're talking about touching a box where somebody sneezed and then touching your face or putting your hand in your mouth, then we're worried about that, right? And also, just to make sure everybody's clear, one thing that really did come out in the last session is that it's not just with people who are coughing. If you're standing in a long line and somebody coughs, that's not the only time when the virus might be communicated. Every time you breathe or speak, you are breathing out little droplets that might have the virus in them. Of course, you could be non-symptomatic for 5 days after having it. So just being around people who are breathing quietly without coughing is a chance to transmit this disease.
Yeah, I think there's a lot that we don't know. And as more information is truly tested and evaluated, we're going to learn more. Unfortunately, it'll probably be at the cost of people's lives. If this is aerosolizable at inhalable droplet size, I don't see them being able to maintain public transport and aircraft, trains, and buses. The massive increase in hospitalizations, what appears to be a relatively large increase in the rate of hospitalizations and fatalities in Italy compared to China, raises the question of why the difference. Recognizing we don't have clear understanding of all or faith in the numbers coming out of China, but if that's the case, you know, one of the things that's different about coronaviruses is they do tend to mutate. They can become more virulent over time. So it is critical that we put the resources, the time, the effort into understanding these basic questions, not just now, but so that we can make better choices, decisions, and actions come the fall to hopefully avoid that second peak.
You know, the definition of clusters in able to testing came out, I think, yesterday when they released the study of that small Italian community.
Yeah,
and they were able to test, the university ran it, and they were able to test everybody. I think it was 3,000 people, maybe.
500, yep.
Right? Yep. And they were able to isolate positive cases, and their caseload did not increase once they did that. It was exactly what every public health official would love to be able to do.
Yeah, but here's the nightmare scenario, nightmare that comes out of that study. If you look at it, I forget the number, but I calculated it was 13.5% of the people in the community tested positive and had absolutely no symptoms whatsoever. If you've got a 10 to 15% carrier rate, you can't base the decision to isolate or to quarantine or to test on symptoms, or you will never get rid of it.
Exactly. And that's why that was a beautiful study.
And what we know right now, or at least is that this virus, unlike some other previous viruses, you tend to be contagious well before you're symptomatic, which is, it makes it, we're actually chasing the dog's tail. You know, it's not, you're not going to know in advance. So that raises the question. So what can people actually do? You know, you hear the term self-isolation, self-quarantine, right? What's the difference? And you know, is this really, how effective can that be? You know, obviously we're trying to flatten the curve. We talked about that in the previous session, because to have, you know, anything we can do to reduce the load at any given point in time is going to make it easier for our healthcare resources to be, you know, utilized for this. But, you know,
Bob, practically speaking, yes, you're going to go home, and whether we want to or not, we're going to see broad-based, population based isolation and quarantine. And it's going to quickly go from voluntary to you gotta. But I think people do need to start begin being given the tools of how do they protect themselves in their home. Again, if 15% of the population is asymptomatic, that means you could have somebody in your home shedding, getting everybody else sick in the home. And so giving people solid information on how do they continue cleaning in their home, disinfecting in their home safely, not using, you know, magic chemicals, but, you know, it's cleaning and disinfecting. We need to stop talking about just disinfecting. You've got to do both. It's got to be every day. And even if nobody else is coming in the house, you should be doing that regardless, because there's a 15% chance someone in the house is already a carrier. So I think that's one aspect. And then also looking forward to the day of normalcy. How do we start bringing facilities, homes, buildings, hotels, airports back into operation. And one of the things we talked about offline was if we just walk away from these buildings, turn off the light switch, lock the doors, what are we going to come back to in 3 to 6 months?
Especially in the South.
Yeah.
We can get away with it a little longer up here in the North. We have a little bit longer window to do that.
Yeah. But I mean, we could be in a point where you're ready to reopen, except you've got a 6 month remediation project to do now with no resources to do it with. So I think educating homeowners and building owners and operators on what they can do now to lower the risk in the future, both for dealing with their buildings as well as dealing with the other issues. And the area that I've been dealing with a lot is Legionnaire's disease, which the cruel irony is that the symptoms of Legionnaire's disease are the same as COVID-19. It's a pneumonia. It's caused by a different organism. But if you shut off the water use to a building and leave it sit stagnant for a couple of months, you run a great increased risk of amplifying Legionella, having people come back into that building, having an outbreak of disease. And what are people going to think it is when they start getting sick?
Really interesting.
Well, it also, doesn't matter what they think it is at that point, though, because that's also a 20% fatality rate with Legionnaire's disease.
That's interesting, too, because this is the shoulder season, and it being spring and it being pollen season for me and Tim, where we're at, people have their homes in heating mode, and it actually requires you to switch that thermostat over to cooling mode for it to dehumidify. So if you're away from your home for the next month, today in Atlanta, it's like 75, 80 degrees. So if now we're in the split, you walk away from your home for 2 weeks, and you might have major humidity problems in the house. So that's a great point, David. Yeah.
Corbett, I still think you're on the right track. And I think the biggest question, if we can help anyone, is to answer the question, what can my family do? Mm-hmm. That's the big thing right now. We have plenty of professionals out there working with all the different healthcare facilities, hospitals. Everyone on the video today is more than adept at working in those answers. But from your communication out through PBS, in terms of how do we solve this on a community-based level, this is an individual disease, and we have to attack it individually. We have to adopt new protocols and learn new ideas, become familiar with the term cross-contamination, and understand, here's how I designate certain areas of my home clean, as David just alluded to, and clean it every day. Biofilms can hold a virus a long time. Now, the virus by itself, if you expose it to sunlight, boom, it's gone. But in a biofilm, who knows? It may linger a lot longer than we think. But right. In your communications back and all your ventures, if you can help educate the family and provide them with, here's some things you can do today to start helping protect your home and your family, that's going to carry over to the workplace. It's going to carry over to any other place they visit. And I think it's a re-education. We need to learn again.
Yeah, you're right. And I think that what's interesting right now is there's a couple of things that really spring to mind immediately, which is that, number one, there are tons of people trying to sell things that are going to do that, what you just described. Mm-hmm. What we talked about this morning, ozone generators. Please, if you are listening to this, no one, let
Silver
anyone
solution.
You know, buy an ozone generator. It does. It's not worth it.
It will cause asthma attacks.
Exactly. All kinds of really horrible things happen.
you okay, Scott?
Number two, right. I mean, there's the air purification, all the disinfectants. Let's clean with ammonia. And then an hour later, let's clean with bleach just to make sure that we really got those suckers. All that stuff is really confusing. And also, when we're talking about home technologies and home stuff. So we're talking about homes that are now more airtight. So if a home is being built today and it's going to be sold tomorrow, it's going to be more airtight. And for that reason, now we have a lot more conversation about the pressure balances. So to Tim's point from earlier, when you walk into our house that we're building right out there, and I'm building this with my parents, this is part of our weird journey, the first thing you walk into is a mudroom, and it does have a laundry in it, but my dryer is a heat pump dryer. So it actually doesn't pressurize that space. So now I'm having to think about this airflow, heat flow, pressure, moisture, contaminant system of how all the science works inside of a home and try and adapt. Because if you just did what your grandparents did, just like what we were talking about earlier. You just hose yourself off before you come inside, blah, blah, blah. Like, there's all kinds of dominoes that then happen, which is the whole topic of this series. And we're going to get more into kind of some of the how-to stuff on part three. But I think that everybody's trying to sell everybody something right now. And that's a dangerous place to be as well.
On the selling of the education.
Yes.
I've been through several emerging issues. I've had to sit as the health department's industrial hygienist and answer questions for, you know, all 8 hours every day from every kind of crazy question you can imagine, with manufacturers of this snake oil or that next base thing coming in. What I will tell people is that I've seen more injuries, illnesses, fatalities, and destroyed buildings due to botched efforts to remediate, clean, disinfect, decontaminate than due to the organism or chemical or whatever they're trying to abate. No one has ever died from bed bugs. I have seen homes blown up. I have seen homes burned down. I have seen people put themselves in the hospital and their children in the hospital because of overzealous attempts to try to get rid of the bed bugs. And I've seen this with mold, I've seen it with bacteria. People will, you know, in the best intentions, do what they think is right. They need guidance, but we're more likely to hurt ourselves trying to do some of these things without education, training, and professional guidance than we are to actually get rid of the contaminant.
Now, Scott, you had something to say. I know you did.
I have seen so much in the last several weeks from people who are 100% disregarding the basic instructions from CDC and now recently from OSHA on how to, what are the first steps. Almost all of those, unfortunately, are somehow in the marketing business. and someone mentioned earlier, you know, there is a plethora, there is unlimited amounts of marketing telling us what to do. People are misrepresenting what it is. We need, as an industry, to point out over and over the CDC's basic recommendation to clean with regular soap and water, just the stuff we have under our sink that we wash our floors and our countertops with, nothing special. Nothing chemical based. The ingredient almost doesn't matter if it's soap, if it's detergent. We even saw that we could get a reduction with just laundry soap, right? There's some suggestion from CDC.
Well Scott, if you could remind people that if they're looking for an EPA registered product, and while, you know, that doesn't mean a lot to folks, if they don't see an EPA registration number on the product that's being touted or has claims of viricidal activity, then they should walk away.
Well, my point, registration right. is- no, I don't mean to interrupt, I'm sorry, but yes. My point is the first step is basic soap and water washing. If we do that, the reduction from washing is huge, right? When we're trying to remove this risk, it's kind of like the biofilm or the spit or the sputum. If we can wash all that off, we now are making it safe. So the little bit that we need to disinfect becomes very low risk. So what's left on the countertop or what's left on even the Amazon box, right?
Well, even the soap in and of itself has viricidal
exactly.
capacity. Right. This is an enveloped organism, and the reason it is infectious is it's able to invade that lipid bilayer of the cells. Right. So the mechanism it uses to get us is how we can get it.
Right, and if we get that word out, and like you said. And the good thing is most products that are on a typical shelf at your typical store that say all-purpose cleaner and disinfectant, they are registered, right? We focus on registration because a lot of people buy, a lot of our constituencies, the people we talk to and train, they're buying it by the 55-gallon drum or they're trying to sell it to contractors to sell it to somebody. But if you just go to the local, you know, the Target, the Walgreens, the Acme, you're going to find common household disinfectants, but you want to get the cleaners first and then worry about the disinfectant and just buy the common easily bought one on the shelf. Don't let people, and this applies to schools and governments and offices, I think, more, because they're going to get the commercial cleaner in there trying to sell them one of these products.
And we're going to be covering more of that in session three. We're at time here now, but I'm going to, if you guys are available to stay a few more minutes on, I'd like to, there's a couple other burning points that I really wanted to get into in the first session. Corbett?
Let's first just point out that there are links for those of you who want to go and take a break before the next session starts at 3 p.m. Eastern. There are links in the chat pane for you to the CDC recommendations that Scott just mentioned are there. There are studies on the transmission rates and people who are coughing versus breathing versus laughing, et cetera. Articles from the New York Times, et cetera. So please do check those out in the chat pane.
And also on our page on healthyindoors.com, where this the event page, which I'm, I'll put the long tail of that back up again. At the end of the description and the schedule for today is a set of links that provided by the Maine Indoor Air Quality Council. It has a lot of ASHRAE, CDC, and a very interesting and alarming Johns Hopkins link to a live world map of constantly logging all the cases of coronavirus or the COVID-19 internationally. So that's would be a great thing to check out and take a look at it. I'll flip that up later. But one of the things that we did, we talked about in the first session, I just want to just raise this to you guys again too, from a different perspective. Talking about the difference in the use, you know, many people out there are wearing hospital surgical type masks versus an N95 or a fitted mask. And, you know, pros and cons. Our Surgeon General came out and said, oh, don't wear a surgical mask because it doesn't provide you any protection, which is true, right? Surgical masks aren't designed to protect the individual. They're designed to stop you from spewing stuff out and dispersing them, you know, in somebody else's
breathing. Very muddied message.
But I think it's important to clarify that, because is there not value in a surgical mask? You know, if we don't know who's infected, people don't present necessarily symptoms. So you know, in Asia, they're highly adopting wearing surgical masks, not so much to protect the individuals, but to do a social responsible thing to stop massive spread. Is there value there?
Yes.
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 You know, but I think because the message is muddled, right? Surgeon General saying, oh, they're no good. Well, they're no good to protect you as the individual.
They're very clear in the earlier days of this that a mask, and they weren't referring to a respirator aura, there was all masks, doesn't do you much good. But then in the next breath, they say, we need those masks for our caregivers. Well, which is it? Does it not work, or we need it for our caregivers? And I tell you, weeks down the road, they will need to promulgate the message that N95s or better respirators are effective at preventing exposure to aerosols from this. So in public health, we've done this many times. We try to prevent panic, but then we say something that we're going to have to eat those words a little bit later. So a very frustrating aspect here, and masks help.
Well, I think what's muddled too is the term mask, right? Because the term mask versus respirator. People see an N95 respirator, which effectively it is a respirator, right? It's a fabric disposable device, but that's right. To a layperson, that's a mask. That's the same as a paper dust mask. They view it the same.
Undifferentiated by most people.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that's another one of those areas. And granted, there's a shortage of both, but, you know, it's certainly something we have to be concerned with. So we're over time here, but there were a couple of questions that I'd like to just try to grab. You know, we were talking in terms of, you know, other than, you know, being able to sequester yourself, stay away from others, how else are we supposed to deal with this situation? Because many people aren't going to have that opportunity to necessarily totally isolate themselves from others. I mean, it sounds great, and it's a, you know, conceptually it makes sense, but, you know, can everybody effectively do that? And if you can't, what other steps do you think we can, you know, suggest that people do in the general public?
Individual responsibility.
Elaborate on that.
Well, okay, I'll give you a perfect case example myself. I'm doing everything I can to strengthen my immune system, to strengthen my respiratory system. I'm doing everything I can so that I will be able to fight things off. And I'm just an individualist. You know me, Bob.
Yep.
I go back to the disease is contracted on an individual basis. If we can fight it on an individual basis, we'll be in much better form to fight it on a collective basis. We'll strengthen our society, and we'll continue to move forward.
You know, we were talking just briefly before about EPA registered products, you know, for the sanitizers, disinfectants and stuff, and they all have anything that claims any type of antimicrobial, efficacy has to be registered. But the fact that it's registered does not necessarily mean it's effective. I think there's
an EPA approved label for that product and the claims that it makes. And
is it the EPA approves it, but EPA is not approving the product per se, right? That's semantics.
They're approving.
No, they're registering.
They're registering.
Not approving anything.
The word approval worries me, David.
No, it's not approval. It's registration.
No, you're right. No. They do approve the label.
They approve the label.
They approve the label. And the label is supposed to be, and I've been through this with clients, on how do you demonstrate efficacy and safety. And they have to deliver to the EPA with those applications data demonstrating efficacy and safety of the product based upon the label they provide. So it is a little convoluted, but if you're making biocidal claims, you better be delivering to the EPA in that, along with that label, data, scientific evidence, measurements, and results demonstrating that you're able to achieve the log reductions listed on the label. So if you're effective against viruses, you need to show you're effective against viruses.
I mean, do we even know? I mean, there's nothing registered for COVID-19 because that's a mutation, and we're assuming that other coronavirus, products that would be effective against the previously known coronaviruses will be effective against COVID-19. Is that a leap of faith that we shouldn't be making, or necessarily?
It's a swag. It's based upon what we know about other envelope viruses. So if you know this fish and lure is going to work on Brim, is probably going to work on shell crackers too. I mean, you have to do some comparisons with what you know in the published literature and about other similar organisms. Yes, they may find that this one may be more, may last longer in the environment, may be more or less susceptible to certain things. But that's where you start, is other similar viruses that are enveloped and, of a similar genetic makeup. So we have that classification of coronavirus. So other coronaviruses, as this is what has been shown to work, that's a good place to start. And you may have to adjust course from there. But I wouldn't write it off and saying, well, we don't know anything about how to treat viruses.
No, I mean, Scott brought that up. Scott nailed it. You start off by removing the debris. You start off by removing the biofilm.
Yes. Okay?
I mean, Dawn dish detergent. Think about
basic hygiene. Basic hygiene.
Yeah, Dawn dish detergent. You can wash your hands with it. You can wash your dishes with it. You can wash your clothes with it. You can wash your floors with it. You can wash your car with it. You can wash your dog with it. It's a surfactant. And Scott nailed it. You just try to get everything cleaned up as best you can, and then worry about the minuscule amount that may be left.
Hey, Tim, look at the Q&A.
There's a specific question
up there.
Yeah, Tim, you address that. I'd like to just bring up one thing real quick, just to remind everybody. We encourage people to try and get everybody in their family, and especially the people who might not take this as seriously, to please do the voluntary quarantining, because there are, number one, the government has the constitutional right, apparently. They used it in 1918-19 with the Spanish flu, to quarantine you legally, to force you to stay home. And if you break quarantine, they could fine you or put you in prison. There's also, I almost got arrested one time when I put someone else in danger. I can't remember what the clause is, but it's under the same legal law in our state of Georgia as if you have HIV and you knowingly then are intimate with someone, you could be put in jail for that. So somebody posted a question, what happens if somebody walks by my house and they breathe on my lawn? And I'm sure that would be an act of God right now. But there are legal, if you have a suspicion that you have the virus and then you go to a grocery store, there is a way for the government to then arrest you if they really felt like it. So let's not take it to that point. Let's all try and be civil about it and protect each other.
Getting back to the question that was asked by Robert. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You need to apply some proper engineering to it. But
read the question over, Tim. Sorry for the question. Because
Tim, have we been asked about moving an entire wing to a negative space, i.e. the ICU. Is this a reasonable or possible request with 100% exhaust through the AHU? I take it it's 100% makeup air unit. Absolutely, and I think that's one of the options that we need to exercise and investigate. Let's utilize what we already have in place. We can't build all new buildings right at the moment, but let's use what we have and figure out how do we adapt them? How do we modify them? And how do we provide, once again, this is my buzzword for the day, sanctuary for the well as well as for the ill.
Now, we had a previous question from the previous session that I think is really fits right in here. Somebody asked, one of the viewers asked, you know, if we're going to be exhausting from, let's say, a hospital unit, a wing where we know people are contaminated and are infected, and we're exhausting, doing 100% outside air, so that means we're exhausting it outside. Are we on the exhaust side? We really don't do great filtration in hospitals, if any, very limited filtration. Right. So are we not potentially kicking viable virus right out the exhaust? And, you know, if that's discharging at street level or somewhere where people could be, is that not potentially a problem?
Absolutely. You have to evaluate that. But we're not talking about the Legionnaires case back in 76 where it drifted down. We're talking about typically most air handler units exhaust to the top of the roof. OK, so, yes.
How about a single story building?
Should you do a downdraft study or quick smoke tube downdraft study? Absolutely. As long as it's not coming out next to the entry for the ER or something like that, I think it's most appropriate, though. Put it out in the sunlight. Sunlight is our number one best disinfectant, without doubt. Put it out there and it's gone.
So there's a question I'd like to just throw out to all of you and give you a chance to, this is kind of our wrap-up thing. But what was one thing or one of the things that you would hope would happen as we move forward, you know, through this crisis, an outcome here? I mean, obviously outcome is, you know, for the least fatalities and the least impact globally, but, you know, what are you hoping to see? You know, what type of changes would you like to see happen as a result of this, this very unique and undesirable situation?
Respect for science.
Good one. I would like to see a reawakening of individual critical thinking and getting away from groupthink. Don't just listen to the TV. Think through the problem yourself. This virus, as I mentioned a moment ago, attacks the individuals. As such, we need to strengthen the individuals on that basis, and then we can solve the collective issues from a much stronger stance. One of the things, and I'll shut up after this, but I often ask potential employees if they have common sense. They all answer yes. But when I challenge them with their definition of common sense, they're befuddled. My definition of common sense is two words: good judgment. Good judgment tells me not to touch the red hot burner on a stove. It tells me not to step in front of a speeding car. Do I know this inherently? No. I had to learn it. I had to learn my good judgment from poor judgment, and hopefully someone else's poor judgment. I would hope we'd have a renewed focus on critical thinking and develop good judgment, which is commonly defined as common sense. And if you've never read it, everyone should read or reread for the first time Thomas Paine's great writing entitled Common Sense and see where our great independent thinkers and freedom lovers are descended from. That's where we get it, guys. That's why we're, those of us particularly on this panel, we're all independent. As you can tell, we probably don't all agree on everything, but we all have common goals. And our common goal is to protect our family, protect our way of life, and protect our freedoms. So I want to see a reawakening of thinking, not just listening and following the crowd.
Critical thinking would be a good thing. David, you look like you're ready to go.
This is just the beginning. This is a marathon, not a sprint. The plans that we need to be making for the fall, the preparations, possibly even, you know, the redirection of industries, efforts, resources to provide enough PPE for healthcare professionals, for maintenance and cleaning, maintenance operators, cleaning custodians, and the general public. We've still got a lot of work to do.
One of the things that really troubles me is in 2003, you know, around the time of the SARS outbreak, when it seemed like it was somewhat contained, there was a hell-bent initiative to do all kinds of research trying to come up with a vaccine. Agreed, it would be it's a different viral strain, but, you know, trying to really prepare and put resources into developing both ways to prevent, ways to, you know, as far as proactive vaccines, but also having our response improve. And that kind of dwindled, you know, because as the threat of that particular outbreak, you know, dwindled, but we stopped putting resources into it. And you know, maybe we'd be in a better situation 17 years later had we not, you know. It's unfortunate. Corbett.
I mean, I think that one of the interesting things about the tack that we're trying to take with normal people is that if energy efficiency and logical thinking had worked with home performance, with the tuning the science of homes, then it would have worked in the 1970s or the 1980s or 90s or 2000s. So really what Grace and I are not afraid to do is to use the same kind of tactics that marketers use, which is to appeal to the reptile brain with equal parts sex appeal, which is the cheerleading side, and fear. And right now there's, you know, the plus side is that people are afraid of their environment. So I don't have to do that as much anymore. But the second part is that they might be afraid of the wrong things, like we were talking about with the trying out the ozone generators and the multiple disinfectants and things like that. There, maybe this is an instance where we might be heading down the wrong path because our fight or flight mechanism tells us that we should be doing something that actually, I think that the common sense thing that Tim was talking about is actually a little more difficult than it appears at first blush, because I think that informed judgment is an important part of good judgment. I think that the fear thing is gonna be, if that's gonna have a lasting impact, and I don't know what's gonna come of that, but I think that it's an interesting thing. It's a good motivator. So we'll things will change.
So we're well over time here. I'm gonna pull the ripcord and end this second session of our day's event. I'd like to thank all of our four panelists here for joining us today. This is, again, I think it's a unique time. You know, these are I'm gonna say interesting times. They're more than interesting. They're troubling times in some ways, in many ways. And we greatly appreciate all of you bringing your various expertise here to this panel, so that we could hopefully share some insight from your perspectives. Our continuing online presentation will reconvene at 3 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. Part three will actually be talking about practical antivirus measures for buildings. So we'll be talking a lot about actually sanitizing, disinfecting, some of the strategies, maybe in a lot of the public spaces, especially where they're going to have to still be utilized to some extent. So stay tuned with us for that. Just to remind everyone that's attending, we will be releasing video recordings of all these sessions later today at healthyindoors.com, along with any of the links and sessions. Again, going back to our page at healthyindoors.com for this event, the bottom of that page, if you scroll down, there's a whole list of links provided by the Maine Indoor Air Quality Council, which will be very helpful. So with that, we'll sign off. I ask you that you stay online if you'd like to. We'll be kicking off the next session in just about 45 minutes. So thanks again, guys.
All right. Thanks, everybody.
Good one.
Good day.
And now, let me restate what I just stated, to recap what I've been reading to you from my PowerPoint slides.
Huh? Webinars suck. We have a better way. Welcome to IAQschool.online. We're different, and that's a good thing. Hi, I'm Bob Krell. I'm the founder and training director of IAQ School. I've been in the training business in the IAQ industry for over 30 years. Our whole vision behind IAQ School Online was to bring that live classroom experience right to you in your own home or office. We provide live, interactive, two-way communication between our instructors and the students for a real live classroom learning experience. IAQschool.online is the next best thing to actually being there. Our exclusive distance learning platform creates a live virtual classroom experience where everyone can truly interact. Students see and hear our instructor's live video feed, our instructor sees and hears the students, and the students can even see each other, just like a real classroom. We utilize a variety of virtual hands-on activities to engage our attendees for a unique and highly effective educational experience. We've just raised the bar over the competition's heads. Great content, great instructors, great value, and amazing convenience. That's IAQschool.online. We're not like the other trainers in the IAQ industry, and we don't want to be. IAQ School.online. We bring the classroom to you.